Hi, I'm Carmen LaBerge. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Hello, friends. Welcome to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. It is the 30th of October, 2018. I've started telling you this because there are now people who listen to this podcast, and they're then scurrying around looking for particular headlines. And if I don't remind people what day it is that we talked about these things, sometimes it's a challenge to pinpoint in time the discussions we're having. So because we focus on the headline news and bringing the mind of Christ to bear on those headlines, I've been encouraged to actually say out loud, hey, it's the 30th of October, 2018. So there you go. Okay, so we could be talking today in an ongoing conversation about the horrific events in Pittsburgh, and we could be talking about the funerals taking place today, those that will take place tomorrow. But I think that what we'll do is we'll turn, not as a distraction, but as an acknowledgement that a lot of folks have already turned from those headlines to others. And so I want to lift up here at the outset today a couple of headlines from the New York Times. Anytime the devil makes a headline in the New York Times, I pay attention. Because the genuinely supernatural does not often get credit, acknowledgement, even a nod that it exists. And so when the devil makes a headline in the New York Times, I think we have to look up from what we're doing. And in this case, we have to look up from our digital devices, from our screens. Here was the headline: a dark consensus about screens and kids begins to emerge in Silicon Valley. Quote, I am convinced the devil lives in our phones. So this is an article by Nellie Bowles. There is a follow-up article related to this entitled Silicon Valley Nannies Are Phone Police for Kids. Childcare contracts now demand that nannies hide phones, tablets, computers, and TVs from their charges. So the dateline here is San Francisco. The people who are closest to a thing are often the most wary of it. Technologists know how phones really work, and many have decided they don't want their own children anywhere near them. A wariness that has been slowly brewing is turning into a region-wide consensus. The benefits of screens as a learning tool are overblown, and the risks for addiction and stunting development are high. The debate in Silicon Valley now is about how much exposure to phones is okay. Quote, doing no screen time is almost easier than doing a little, says Kristen Stecker, a former social computing researcher who's married to a Facebook engineer. Quote, if my kids get to do it at all, she's talking there about screen time. And when these people are talking about screen time, they're talking about all screens. They're talking about watching movies on your television. They're talking about a screen of any kind, an iPad, a Kindle, a DS, certainly a smartphone. Any sort of connected device counts that has a physical screen. They're talking about screens in their cars. They're talking about screens of every type, and there's a reason, and it's because of this evidence of that they're highly addictive. At one point in this article, they're actually asked, "Hey, on a scale between candy and crack cocaine, what kind of addiction level are we talking about?" And Mr. Anderson, who's the former editor of Wired magazine and now the chief executive of a robotics and drone company, the founder of GeekDad.com, says, no question, on a scale between candy and crack cocaine, it's closer to crack cocaine. So some of the people who built these video programs are now horrified by all of the places that kids can access screens and screen-based material. And it is an assistant for Mark Zuckerberg. Her name is Athena Chaviera, who is quoted as saying, I am convinced the devil lives in our phones and is wreaking havoc on our children. She did not let her own children have cell phones until high school. That seems to, by the way, be the trend in this article. We're talking about people who are at the highest levels of each and every one of these organizations. We're talking about the heads of Apple. Tim Cook, CEO of Apple, said earlier this year he would not let his nephew join social media networks. Bill Gates banned cell phones until his children were teenagers. Melinda Gates wrote she wished they had waited even longer. Steve Jobs does not let his young children anywhere near an iPad or any other connected device. And they are all now paying nannies who have to sign no phone contracts to actually monitor that their children have no access to screens of any kind. John Lilly, who's a Silicon Valley-based venture capitalist, is trying to help his 13-year-old son understand that he's being manipulated by those who have developed the technology. He says, I try to tell him, somebody wrote that code that's making you feel that way. I'm trying to help him understand how the things are made and the values going into things and what people are doing to create those feelings he's having. My 13-year-old son, he's like, I just want to spend my $20 to get my Fortnite skins. I'll admit to you, I don't really know what a Fortnite skin is, but I suspect it's something that you buy that advances you in some part of the gaming world in a digital universe. Here's the bottom line. These technology developers, these tech icons, these people who have made literal fortunes off of all of this. My producer is telling me it's an outfit for your character. Uh-huh. I clearly have characters, and obviously if I had characters, they'd all be naked because I got no Fortnite skins. I don't even know. Okay. So all of these people are saying, hey, look, we thought we could control it. And then we realized this is beyond our power to control. This is going straight to the pleasure center of the developing brain of the child. This is beyond your capacity as a parent to even understand. Now, this is coming from a person who has five children. They have 12 tech rules. The rules include no phones until the summer before the child is in high school. No screens ever in the bedroom. Network level content is blocked always. Now, network level means, you know, you're on the internet. That is blocked in their home. No social media at all until the age of 13. No iPads at all. Screen time schedules are enforced by Google Wi-Fi that he controls from his own phone. Bad behavior, you go offline for 24 hours, no conversation. He said, I didn't even know what I was doing to their brains until I started to observe the symptoms and the consequences. They talk about the unintended consequences and the scar tissue left behind and how hard it is then to help your kids through what has become utter addiction. I got to tell you, this is troubling. And it's troubling because we've literally all bought in. And so even though I'm now going to tell you about the six most dangerous apps for teens, as soon as I tell you that, I'm acknowledging that our teens, for the most part, have access, unlimited access, to their phones, onto which they can download all kinds of apps that we don't know about, and certainly about which we don't know. Just in terms of an equipping resource, the ERLC, the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission of the Southern Baptist Convention, at ERLC.com in their resource library, has an article entitled The Six Most Dangerous Apps for Teens. And I think it's important. I think it's important for us to know about Snapchat and Marco Polo, Yellow, which has been called Tinder for teens, which if you don't know what Tinder is, whew, scary stuff. There's a site called sayit.me. There's a site called After School, and there's a site called an app called Calculator with a little percentage sign. By the way, Calculator with a percentage sign is not a calculator. I mean, it is a calculator, but it's not a calculator. It's been pulled from the Apple Store in April, but a lot of people already have it on their phones. It hides pictures and videos behind a password-protected button within the app that you would never even know was there. So there's all kinds of apps that you can use to help protect your teen. There's one called Bark. There's one called Limitly, L-Y. And there's one called Track Kids. Kids ends there with a Z. That can help you and your kids make wise decisions. But the reality is, this is like crack cocaine. I think that's what the people in the technology world in Silicon Valley are now telling us. They're now admitting they created a monster. In fact, one person in Silicon Valley says, look, it's not even a monster we created, but it is a monster that we gave access to our kids. And that monster, she goes right out and says, is the devil. Like, we're talking about something that is so addictive and evil that that one person even went so far as to call it the devil itself. Okay, on Friday, we're going to talk right here on Connecting Faith with Ed Stetzer. And one of the conversations that I intend to have with Ed is about his piece that's posted today at the Exchange blog at ChristianityToday.com. The reason I want us to talk about it is it's about the website and app called Gab. And you've probably heard of Gab in the last couple of days because Gab is the website that the Pittsburgh shooter used and where it is believed he was radicalized. And so we want to talk about Ed's experience being targeted by people on Gab, how his own family has come under threat of people on that very hostile site. So we're going to talk with Ed Stetzer about that on Friday. But today, coming up next, we're going to have another conversation with Matthew Sorens. You know Matthew. He's been here with us several times on Connecting Faith. He's the U.S. Director of Church Mobilization for World Relief. He's also the National Coordinator for the Evangelical Immigration Table, the co-author of Welcoming the Stranger. He's going to join us to react to several headlines related to immigration, including the migrant caravan, the deployment of U.S. troops to the southern border, and more. So you are listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge, and we'll be right back. Hey, friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. I am joined in conversation by our frequent guest, Matthew Sorens. Matthew is the U.S. Director of Church Mobilization for World Relief. You can find him on Twitter at World Relief and also at Matthew Sorens. Matthew, welcome back to Connecting Faith.
Yeah, it's great to be back with you, Carmen.
So I think that what we'll do today, since there are so many immigration-related headlines, maybe I will simply read the headline and let you kind of react and respond to it. Tell us what you think we need to know, and then how Christians should think about it. So the first one would be threatened executive order related to birthright citizenship.
Yeah, so I think there's a couple challenges there. So the president made this comment in an interview, I believe recorded yesterday, that he was going to use an executive order to end birthright citizenship. The idea that if you were born in the United States, you are a citizen of the United States, regardless of who your parents are or their legal status or anything like that. I think the biggest challenge is just the idea that you can undo that principle with an executive order. That comes to us from the 14th Amendment. It was ratified into our Constitution in the post-Civil War era, really responding to a bad decision, I think I could say, from the Supreme Court that decided that a freed slave, African-American, was not a citizen, the Dred Scott case. And it has been subsequently considered by the Supreme Court going back to 1890 that this certainly includes someone who was born to parents who are not eligible for citizenship. In that case, in 1890, it was because they were Chinese. So this is not really an open question legally. I mean, it's a good debate whether we should have this rule. There are countries in Europe that have gotten rid of birthright citizenship, but you can't undo the Constitution with an executive order. That part is pretty clear. My personal view is that it would be a mistake to undo birthright citizenship, which many countries in the Western Hemisphere have, in part because it's a problem that we have 11 million immigrants unlawfully present in the country. It's great that their children are not unlawfully in the country. They are fully American, and they are fully integrated into our society. About a quarter of the Fortune 500 companies in the world were in the United States were started by a child of immigrants. How many of those wouldn't exist if they hadn't had a valid social security number to be able to start a business and go on to education and that sort of thing? This is an incredible number of people within our churches as well who would be affected by this, at least going forward, and had this been the case in the past. So I don't think it's a good idea, but I'm especially troubled by the legal proposal for how to do this. And I think the courts would probably pretty quickly affirm that you cannot do this by executive order.
So I feel like even though I told you we were going to go next to like the migrant caravan and the threat to send troops to the border, I think that my preference would be to jump to the last conversation that you and I were planning to have because it feels like it's more connected to this first conversation. And so remind us, if you will, people who have been here in the United States under temporary protected status. Some of them have been here more than 20 years. And so they've had kids here. So their kids are citizens. But now those people who came here under temporary protected status are facing deportation because that temporary protected status is being lifted and they're being ordered out of the country. Can you help us understand like what that does to a family? And if we're really pro-life and we're really pro-family, then what kind of conversations do we need to be having as Christians around these issues?
Yeah. So I think the critique of temporary protected status, or TPS, is that it has proven over time not to be very temporary. As you said, some of these people have had their temporary protected status renewed for more than 20 years, and especially people from El Salvador, from Honduras. So there's hundreds of thousands of these people, I mean, 200,000 just from El Salvador alone. And it is, unfortunately, still not safe to be sent back to El Salvador. They have, in recent years, have had the highest homicide rate in the world. So other administrations have always extended the status, which means people who came maybe in the early 90s, either with a temporary visa or unlawfully, were granted legal protections back then and have been in legal status ever since. They've not qualified for public benefits, so it means they must have been working to provide for themselves. Many of them have had children in those 2 decades who are, because of birthright citizenships, who are citizens of the United States. So as this has been withdrawn, and basically they were told there's no more renewal, so this is your last turn. Within a couple of years, you will lose your protections. That means you could be deported. It certainly means you will not have a work authorization card, which means you will, if your employer is following the law, you'll lose your job. So it's a real issue for families. As you can imagine, if you've grown up in this country, you were born 19 years ago, and all of a sudden your parents are going to be deported to a country that you've never been to before, that they haven't seen in decades. That's actually quite dangerous right now. I mean, that's why we see these caravans coming out from Central America, is significantly because of the violence in those countries. Not to mention, even if you're not deported, you lose your job, or at least you're driven into a black market to find a way to support your family. And when people have mortgage payments and car payments and rent to pay, tuition to pay, all those things have a significant economic impact as well. And at a time when our unemployment rate is 3.7% or so, I think it's just really short-sighted for the American economy as well to take all those hardworking people who have been working with authorization, have been paying their taxes, out of the economy.
So again, friends, my conversation partner is Matthew Sorens. You can follow him on Twitter at Matthew Sorens. You can also find his work if you follow World Relief on Twitter. Or if you look for the Evangelical Immigration Table, there are all kinds of really great resources posted for you there as well. If you want to understand the policy issues that we're talking about today, I would really encourage you to grab a copy of Welcoming the Stranger. It's out in its second edition, and it certainly will help you understand and explore the breadth and depth of the considerations that we need to be making in relationship to immigrants, those seeking asylum, and all of the conversations that we're having today. So, Matthew, let's talk about the migrant caravan. And you can approach this either way you want to, because I have two headlines in front of me. One of them is that Trump is going to deploy 5,200 troops to the southern border. The other one is related to the migrant caravan itself and the people who are headed from Central America to the U.S. southern border. So however you want to approach the conversation, please help us have it.
Yeah, I mean, I think the most important thing for people to realize is that they should not be afraid of this, so-called caravan. At this point, these people are 1,000 miles from any U.S. border port of entry. And actually, most of them have said they want to go to Tijuana, which is a significant distance even beyond that, because it's on the West Coast. They are very desperate people who've been walking for a really long time. They're weeks away from ever getting to the border if they do. And it's very possible the Mexican government will intervene. In fact, ironically, I think the Mexican government probably would have intervened by now had it not been for all the attention, because our president is not necessarily very popular in Mexico. And most Mexican politicians don't want to be seen as taking orders from the president of the United States right now. So it almost may have been counter-effective in all the U.S. pressure to say, stop these people. Mexican government deports tons of Central Americans. I was in San Salvador a year ago, and there were 10 times more people being deported from Mexico on buses than there were being deported on planes from the United States coming back to El Salvador. But because of some of the domestic political dynamics, they're tolerating them, and churches in Mexico are helping these people. You know, I think the most important thing I would encourage people is to remember that we are followers of Jesus. The government has a role to protect people. That's appropriate. I just think it's really hard to make the case that these people are a threat. I can't guarantee who everyone in that caravan is, but there's no particular reason to believe that there are, you know, potential terrorists or that sort of thing. But in any case, based on their own statements, they want to come to the United States to avail themselves to the protections of U.S. law. They want to come to the port of entry and request asylum. So we should adjudicate each case. That's what our law tells us to do. Laws, the international treaties that we are a party to, and laws going back to the Refugee Act of 1980, some of them will qualify under U.S. law for asylum because they have a well-founded fear of persecution for the particular reasons under the law. Some of them are fleeing poverty, not persecution. They won't qualify. But we can treat them decently and humanely, and you know we should enforce the law. We don't just let everyone into this country. But they're coming to us asking for help. They're looking for officers of the U.S. government to adjudicate their case. They're not trying to sneak in. They're not trying to harm anyone. And I think there's a lot of fear right now, and I'm worried that a lot of Christians have sort of forgotten that we're a follower of Jesus, who himself had to flee his country and cross over a border into Egypt as a small child, who told us in Matthew 25 that when we welcome a stranger who's one of the least of these brothers and sisters, we are doing so unto him. And I'm not saying that the U.S. government's role is to take everyone, but the role of the church is really clear, and we can encourage our government to exercise compassion and to respect the law, both as it comes to, yes, protecting our borders, but also honoring our commitments under U.S. law to make sure that we do not send anyone back who qualifies for asylum, because we could be sending them back to be killed. I mean, we have done that at shameful moments of U.S. history, especially if you think about people fleeing, Jews who were fleeing the early days of Nazi period. We're all embarrassed that we sent folks of Jewish people back to be killed. And that's why we have the asylum laws that we have today, to make sure we don't make that mistake again. And it would be an error not to respect those laws.
Well, we're embarrassed that we did those things if we know we did them, if we remember that we did them, if we've been educated to acknowledge that we did them. I think part of the challenge that we face, Matthew, is that there is not a shared basis of information. There's lots of misinformation. There's certainly mischaracterization. You and I both know it's really hard to hate up close. It's really hard to hate an individual. But you know, I can hate that which you make me fear. And so what it feels like, is often happening is this desire to foment fear, which then we have seen, if I can make somebody fear the other, I can theoretically make them do things that would demonstrate hate of the other. Now, for Christians, neither of those things is righteous, not the fear
That's
nor
right.
the hate. And so I think that as Christians, we have to just continually take a step back. We have to say, how as a Christian am I supposed to be seeing these things? What's God's perspective on these issues and concerns? Set the politics aside long enough to acknowledge not only the humanity of the other, but my calling as an ambassador of the kingdom in the midst of the kingdoms of this world. So we
yeah.
certainly thank you for all that you're doing at the Evangelical Immigration Table. Hey, you and I are going to have to leave it right there. Friends, you can find Matthew on Twitter at Matthew Sorens. You can also find him at World Relief, and you can find him at the Evangelical Immigration Table. Thank you, Matthew, for joining us again today on Connecting Faith. Friends, I got to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking with Jason Stonehouse about something more. Hey, friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. Thrilled to be joined today by Pastor Jason Stonehouse. Jason is the lead pastor of Grace Church in Roseville, Minnesota. He's also the author of Something More. He's tweeting at Stonehouse Jason, and you can also find his blog and podcast at lifeinprocess.com. Jason, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Thanks, Carmen. It's great to be here.
So every author, it seems to me, every author that I have encountered to this point is trying to scratch a particular itch, usually an itch that is annoying for pastors, the sheep they love. So what's the issue that you're seeking to address or the question you're seeking to answer in Something More?
Well, you know, I grew up in going to church pretty much my whole life. My grandparents were missionaries in Africa, and so I had been so enculturated, if you will, by church and religion and faith. And there came a point in high school where I was starting to – I had this moment where I just looked down at all these fellow high school students. We were sitting in the back row of the balcony in our church, so it couldn't get further away from the pastor if we tried. And the focus that I had at that point was, I said, there's got to be more to faith than this. There's got to be more than just going to church and reading the Bible, and all those things are wonderful, but I was just feeling like there was a stagnant piece to my faith. And I, as I read the scriptures and I read the stories of all these Bible characters and all these people that were experiencing God in some really, really powerful ways, and I'm like, am I putting too much ice in mine? Because my faith doesn't sound like that. My faith doesn't look like that. I felt like I was just kind of going through the motions. And so really, this book is about a probably 20-year journey to just discovering what is that more that it really means to have a faith that's alive, that's a close personal relationship with God, where you're seeing Him regularly move and change lives and use your gifts and your abilities to do things. And so I just kind of said, hey, be a fellow journeyer with me, and let's discover what something more might look like in your faith.
Okay, I guarantee you that right now there's people listening and they're like, that is me. That is so me. And so let me just go ahead and tell folks, yes, we have some books. We have some copies of the book, Something More. If you would like to enter a drawing for the copies that we have, you can text me at 877-933-2484. If you'd go ahead and text your email address, that would be like the most helpful way to get started here on that subject. So text your name and your email address to 877-933-2484. Or if you can email, that's great too. You can email me, Carmen@myfaithradio.com. And if you do it that way, go ahead and give us your physical mailing address, which obviously is ultimately what we need in order to send you something. So we got a drawing for copies of Something More. So Jason, let's just dive in a little bit to the content of the book.
Sure.
Because I think that will sort of help people get a sense of what's in there. So I'm going to ask it this way. What does it mean to embrace life as a process?
Well, I think sometimes we look at life through this lens that says, I want to get to this point, or I want to arrive at this stand. And I think a lot of times, even in churches, we call people to these big radical steps of faith. And people look at this and like, man, I could never be that. I could never go that far. I could never be that on fire. And so we almost become spectators of other people's journey. And one of the things that I've learned over the years is that it's all about one step closer, that if I can start to take one step in the right direction, and then another step, and then another step, I look back a year later and say, wow, look at how far I've come along. But if we embrace this idea that faith is these individual mile markers, if you will, then we don't really appreciate the process. So one of the big things I say with a life in process is it's all about humility. I have to come to a point to realize, you know what? I'm not where I want to be. I'm not experiencing my faith. And sometimes we look around at our fellow people at church and we say, man, it just seems like they've got something I don't have, but we kind of fake it, you know? We don't want to admit that we don't have that. And so we just kind of go through and just kind of keep our head down and not worry about it. But part of life in process is this idea that says, no, I'm going to be hungry for more. And so I'm willing to admit I'm not where I want to be. I'm not going to settle for good enough. I'm going to look for some next steps, whatever that next step, no matter how big or small it might be, what's my next step? And then I think a big thing for my own journey, and really that I bring out in the book, is this concept of reflection. This time that we are so busy as people that we're always running here and there, doing everything, and we don't take time to just stop and reflect and say, you know what? What's God doing in my life? Why am I getting so stressed about X? You know, why am I so angry about whatever? And if we don't take the time to reflect, we're never going to make some progress and movement forward. And so we've got to reflect and say, where's this stuff coming from? What's going on in my heart? What can I bring before God? And what could be some next steps that I take in the process?
Okay, friends, you are hearing the voice of Jason Stonehouse. He is a pastor at Grace Church in Roseville, Minnesota. We're talking today about his book, Something More. You can find more information at lifeinprocess.com. So, Jason, one of the things that you said in answer to that question, which I made lots of notes about, is that you allude to this idea of hunger.
Mm.
But I think that, you know, in addition to imagining that I want something more, I need a little taste of it in order that I could develop an appetite for something more. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think one of the reasons we don't have that appetite is there's really two main reasons that I bring out in the book. One is that we settle for junk food. What I mean by that is we fill ourselves with so many things of the world that we almost are not hungry for more of God, because we're looking to our jobs or our relationships or whatever it might be to kind of fill that place. Now, if you're a follower of Jesus and you say, okay, well, I want to continue to grow, sometimes we settle for the second thing, which I call spiritual fast food. And if you think about fast food, there's two things about fast food. It's cheap and it doesn't take much time. And I think a lot of us take our relationship with God like fast food, where we don't want it to cost us too much. We don't want to spend too much money on it. And we want it to go fast. We want to be able to, you know, be transformed in a microwave that's just going to happen in 3 seconds or less, you know. And so part of that hunger is to allow ourselves to have that appetite by looking at the things that we're falsely filling ourselves with. When I was growing up, my mom used to always tell me that I couldn't have any soda or pop, depending on where you are in the country, you know, before dinner, because those
or Coke.
Yeah, if you're in the South, right? Yeah,
please. No, it's not soda or pop down here. It's Coke.
That's right. Well, she would always say, you know, you can't have that because the soda bubbles and all that, they give you this feeling of being full, but you're not really full, and you'll be hungry, you know, very soon afterwards. And I think a lot of us do that with our spiritual lives, that we fill up on things that are really not going to be filling us, and so we miss out on that hunger. So part of it, I think, is just getting ourselves to a place where we're willing to admit there is a hunger there. And then I think it's when you start to take those steps, take those whatever steps of faith that might look like, you begin to see God working, and you're saying, ooh, if I could just have that, if I could just have what I experienced for this last hour to be more consistent in my life, how amazing would that be? And so you get kind of excited and you start to feed that appetite even more.
It's a little bit like working out.
Yeah.
Right?
It is.
Yeah, it's really hard to start, but man, once you get going, then what you feel and what you can do and what you experience is so much more satisfying.
Yeah.
So again, friends, I am talking with Jason Stonehouse. We're talking about his book, Something More. We do have some copies to give away. If you'd like to enter a drawing for those copies, you can text me at 877-933-2484, or you can email me, carmen@myfaithradio.com. So, Jason, Something More is not just about me. It's not just about an individual experience. It's about more in terms of relationship and influence. Can you share with folks what you mean by that?
Yeah, I would say I spent a lot of my life as a young Christian thinking that, you know, the individualism of America to say, I'm going to do it myself, and it's going to be me and God, and we're going to make it all happen. But through some really challenging experiences in my life early on, I started realizing the critical piece of relationships, that this idea of community, and I think what a lot of churches and a lot of Christians will call small groups, are often more social, more just fellowship gatherings, if you will, rather than true communities where we're able to go deep, where we're able to admit, hey, I'm not all that I want to be, and hey, I'm not the best dad that I want to be, and you know, I'm struggling in this area of my faith. And I think if we can start to create communities where that becomes the norm, where people are doing life together, that's when Something More becomes a team sport, if you will, as opposed to an individual pursuit. And so I think if we could start to, and I found in my own small groups that I had to go first. You know, I had to model this willingness to be authentic, to be vulnerable, to maybe even be a little raw at times with the people in my group, so that I could kind of invite them into that same kind of relationship. But then I think once you start to live that way, you start to realize that, wow, I'm having influence beyond just my group. And I found as a pastor, when we have groups that are really going there relationally, what happens is other people are like, I want that. That's what I thought church was just about, you know, doing the Bible study and going through the motions, if you will. But when you get a community that really truly is community, it changes things.
So Let's talk about the something more that is yet to come, because I like that you cast the vision of what God's got in mind in terms of what is still yet something more.
Mm. Yeah. Would you mind if I just read the last paragraph of the book here? I write this. Listen, I don't want to wish you were here. I've spent too long as a pastor wishing people would engage in this journey. I've been tempted to lower the standards and settle for the way things are. But there's too much at stake. It's time for both you and me to move towards God's design for us. Good enough isn't good enough anymore. God is waking us up and calling us forward. I'm jumping into the wave, and I pray that you'll join me in his movement forward. For me and you, for his people, and for the world. There's no more time for compromised lives, complacent faith, or foolish sin. Something more is waiting, and someone more is inviting us to put down the postcard and experience the journey of a lifetime. And that's really my passion, I think, for the church and for Christians, is I just feel like the kind of world that we are becoming, with all the pressures that our world is throwing at us, if we just have a faith that's going through the motions, it will not last. But if we have a faith that is vibrant and alive and really continuing to see these things happen as we go forward, I think people will, number one, be attracted to that. And I think we will have the depth and the strength in our relationships to really endure whatever the evil one and whatever the world wants to throw our way. We're going to be able to stand strong in the midst of that, because we're awake and we're alive in our faith. And that's just something that I wish for every single follower of Jesus.
Hey, friends, you can connect with Pastor Jason Stonehouse at Grace Church, which is in Roseville, Minnesota. You can also connect with him at his ministry website, lifeinprocess.com. You can connect with him on Twitter at Stonehouse Jason. Jason, you know, I think that there are just a lot of folks who have no idea, like, what pastors wish would happen on a Tuesday. Like, if there's somebody that's listening right now, and they're, you know, maybe they're listening live, you know, in the Twin Cities area. You know, that's where you are geographically. When you think of, you know, it's Tuesday, and when you think about that as a pastor, what would you hope that people within your own geography would know that pastors want today? Like, that you're open to something today. I know you are. I know you're open to something that people don't necessarily know pastors are open to. What is that?
I think I'm not sure which you're trying. I know you're trying to feed it to me here, but
I'm not really. I just have a sense that like most pastors, there's a longing in your heart.
I want it to be real. I want people's faith to be real, to be not something that is just, you know, another sermon, another church service, another Bible study, another book for me to read, but really that this faith is something that changes us and transforms us from the inside out. One of the things I always say with every single sermon that I prepare on the weekend is my goal is not to get the, hey, good job, Pastor, you blessed my heart. But my goal at the end of the sermon is I want to get that sermon out of the room. I want somebody to be thinking about it on Tuesday. I want somebody to be wrestling with, what could God be saying to me through that? What does God want to do in my life? Because I want to see people's lives be transformed, not just that we've gone through the faith motions.
So in journalism, there's this concept that there's, you know, you cover something as like a breaking news story.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the newsroom, you're always having a conversation about whether or not this story will have any legs.
Mm.
Like you're thinking to yourself, like, you know, is there going to be a follow-up story I can do? Is there a thread in this that I could pull? Is there another, you know, is there a lane of this that I could follow into the future so that you don't have to go, you know, sort of back and do all the research over again? You're looking for a story that has legs.
Sure.
And so one of the things that I hear you saying is, I don't really want the sermon to be something that's contained in an experience between you as the preacher and the people, you know, physically present in a congregation at any given moment, or even those who happen to be listening via streaming or via podcast. You want it to have legs. You want to see
exactly.
That sermon walk itself out into the world as Christ is going, embodied in those believers by the power of the Holy Spirit, as real agents of his grace into the world that he so loves.
Yes.
And that's, I think that if people really knew that that's the heart of the pastor, they would be more inclined to call us up and, you know, and share their need for that kind of real faith and their hunger and thirst for righteousness. I think it's out there in the culture. Mm-hmm. I just don't think that everybody knows that. That's really, pastors are open to that.
Yeah. And I think a lot of times people think we just want them to go to our programs, and they don't realize that every program that we put together is really meant to be a tool in their journey to help them be transformed. And so it's not about attending a program, a women's group, a men's group, whatever. It's really about using those environments as tools that can really shape you and transform you going forward.
Oh, I just love it. All right, friends, you can hook up with Jason personally at Grace Church in Roseville, Minnesota. You can do so on Twitter. He's at Stonehouse Jason. You can connect with him on his ministry website, lifeinprocess.com. The book is Something More. If you want to enter a drawing for that, you can text me at 877-933-2484 or email me, Carmen@myfaithradio.com. Jason, thank you so much for joining us today on Connecting Faith.
Yes, thank you. Great
friends,
fun.
I got to take one more quick break. When we come back, we'll be making the connecting point. I'm Carmen LaBerge. You're listening to Connecting Faith. Hey friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. Let's get to it. Let's make the connecting point. So I'm tempted in today's connecting point to like share a thought that's not yet fully developed, but I think that I better put that off a little bit longer until the thought is more fully developed and I've actually like worked it out. But let me just tell you in advance that a dear friend of mine is helping her mom sort through what I will describe as the aftermath of her stepfather's death. And so, you know, there's all kinds of emotional things related to that. There's all kinds of life things related to that. And because obviously, well, maybe not obviously, but her stepdad had kids in his first marriage. And then he has, you know, obviously very long-term relationships with my friend and her sibling as well. And so there's, you know, there's just a lot there. There's all these layers of relationships and what to do and who wants what. And so today's big dilemma, and she sent me a picture this morning. Today's big dilemma is related to his what are called cremains. So the remains of the person after cremation. So I'm now openly receiving input. I'll just put it this way. I need some listener input on cremains. You know, whatever your thoughts are, I am now open to receiving them. So, you know, you can text me 877-933-2484. You can email me if you have a lot to say. Email's better. Carmen@myfaithradio.com. Or, you know, if you're on Twitter, you can let me know what your thoughts are on cremains. I'm at Carmen LaBerge. So I need a little input so that I don't I don't run off in a direction that, well, is just, I mean, we, you know what? We'll talk about all things related to burial versus cremation. We could have that conversation, but obviously that is not a debate in this particular family. The debate is very much about whether or not the cremains need to be kept together. And if so, well, frankly, it's already too late for that. And then anyway, they're currently being carried around in a brown paper shopping bag that was like takeout food. Anyway, it's mind boggling. So anyway, so if you have thoughts on cremains, I would love to hear them. Tomorrow is Halloween, but it's also Reformation Day. And so I wanted to just lift up, you know, if you're a Protestant, you know, tomorrow actually matters to you in a really significant way. Reformation Day commemorates what is perhaps, well, I think a lot of people would acknowledge that it was a great move of God's Spirit, and it took place 501 years ago now. But the significance of Reformation Day in terms of how we ought to be thinking about it, what actually happened when Martin Luther, who was a Roman Catholic priest, because that's what there was at the time in terms of in Western culture, he nailed something called the 95 Theses, which I have seen commemorated by people who like the right kind of candy and have nailed 95 Reese's peanut butter cups to their front doors. And I think that if you are going to give away candy on Halloween, give away the best kind. If you have 95 Reese's on your front door and you paint your pumpkin to look like Martin Luther, then somehow you're redeeming Halloween. This is at least a notion in my mind. It could be wrong. Could be completely errant, but there you go. So Martin Luther nailed what we call the 95 Theses to a church door in Wittenberg, Germany, on October the 31st, 1517. You probably saw lots of commemorations of this last year because it was the 500th anniversary. Well, it's not as if, you know, the Reformation came and went in that one day. In fact, the Reformation unfolded, and some would argue is still unfolding today. But it certainly unfolded for a very long period of time, not only in Germany, but across Western Europe, and then obviously over here on the other side of the pond, as we as others like to refer to it. So anyway, so it provoked a lot of debate. It culminated in what we now call the Protestant Reformation. And so if you're a Protestant Christian, tomorrow is important to you, not as Halloween and not as All Hallows Eve, which is what Roman Catholics would acknowledge that tomorrow is. But it's important to you as a Protestant Christian because it is Reformation Day. And initially, what Martin Luther was protesting was a really, you know, quite a great controversy of the time. And it's probably even really hard for us to imagine now that there was this attempt to sell salvation. That not only could it, were there these things that you had to do to earn God's grace, but that you could pay these indulgences to actually buy someone's salvation who had died outside of God's grace. And so you can imagine that when Luke read passages like Ephesians chapter 2 or 2 Corinthians chapter 5, this perfect righteousness of Christ imputed, declaring people to be not guilty and forgiven of their sins and righteous in his sight because of the perfection of Jesus. You can see how as a monk reading these passages of scripture, you know, Luther would be like, okay, so either the Bible is right or, well, and the Pope is wrong. And so that's essentially, you know, when you talk about the 95 Theses, there's a lot of it that is related to that one issue, the selling or buying of indulgences. And so I think that if you're going to talk about something tomorrow in relationship to what is Reformation Day, if you're going to talk about Reformation Day in terms of its ongoing importance, you know, continuing to affirm that we are saved by grace alone, through faith alone, in Christ alone, that we come to this knowledge through the Bible alone, that there are not like equivalent revelations to the Bible and nothing needs to be added to it. And that all of it is to the glory of God alone. Like if you're looking for things to talk about tomorrow, the solas, those are what those are called, by the way, the solas of the Reformation is a good place to start. I think the other conversation that you could have on Reformation Day is that we're not just reformed and always being reformed according to whatever, you know, whimsy of the time. We're actually supposed to be reformed and always being reformed according specifically to the Word of God. And so if you want to, you know, celebrate Reformation Day, then maybe consider examining your own life anew for ways in which you would like for God to continue to bring you into greater conformity with his will and his word. There's also a great post at factsandtrends.net called 6 Ways to Engage Your Neighbors on Halloween. And if you're looking for some ideas like and answers to the question, is it okay for Christians to even celebrate Halloween? And should I call it Reformation Day? What do I do if there's a trunk or treat? All of these kinds of things. Well, Justin Tucker lays out some ideas here that we can get involved, we can serve, we can create a space for people to hang out, we can talk, we can listen, we can pray, we can follow up. But there's all kinds of ways to not just let Halloween be a time when we are completely co-opted by the culture, but where we really are people of spiritual influence, exalting Jesus Christ always and in all ways. All right, friends, that's literally all the time we've got here today on Connecting Faith. You can visit me online at myfaithradio.com on the Connecting Faith page or at my ministry website, reconnectwithcarmen.com. Have a great day, and God bless.
Thanks for listening to this conversation from Connecting Faith. These podcasts are available because of listener support. You can make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend to grow the impact of Connecting Faith. Also, take a moment to subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player and never miss a conversation.